Okay, I just turned off of Paseo. I'm going up a hill, which is really kind of pretty. So, yesterday afternoon, I went to check out a parcel of land at 21st and Tracy. There are birds gathering on a barren tree, and there's this little turnoff, just a dead-end street with a fire hydrant and some trash. But yeah, no one here except me and some birds. That little plot of land I visited yesterday was relinquished by the Parks Department in a vote back in November. Remember that? Well, we have been wondering why the Parks Department keeps asking the voters' permission to give up parcels it no longer deems, quote, necessary or appropriate for park or boulevard use. What makes parcels of land inappropriate? And is the Parks Department done getting rid of them? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show starts with Mark McHenry. He's the director of Parks and Rec for Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Gina.
What does make a parcel undesirable, or I guess technically unnecessary or inappropriate from your department's standpoint?
Well, Gina, as we look throughout our park and boulevard system, there's pieces of land that we would, the terminology would be no longer deemed for park purposes. And that's how the resolution is written by the park board. And the example you gave off of Tracy and the Paseo is a small tract of land, a little less than 3 acres. That doesn't really add value to the park system, and we believe that was something that we should take to the voters and get their response on whether that could be removed from the park and boulevard system.
So let's stick with the one I visited just a little bit. Was there ever a grand plan for that parcel, like for recreation? Because it felt kind of like random dead space carved up by the way Troost, Paseo, and 71 kind of meet over there.
Well, there's a kind of a front side and a back side of that piece of land. Part of that land that faces to the east is actually adjacent to the Paseo Boulevard right away. And if you drive Paseo at that location, you'll see a lot of green space. And then as you get further to the west, which would be the eastern face of that land, it's a wooded area, as you mentioned earlier. And then on the Tracy side, there is an old building. That building has been there for several years. It was our operation for our tree service operation, so it was a maintenance facility, but it's long since seen its use as a maintenance facility. So it's a building that needs to be removed at some point in the future. So that building is on the other side of the property there along Tracy, and has no longer a park purpose at all associated with that building.
Okay, so I guess this does bring up the question. The location of it feels like, could there be some, I mean, it's not useful, I guess, in the way it's being used or not used right now, and it's not adding value doing what it's doing right now, but is there some potential for it? I mean, it would be easy for me to imagine this size of a piece of land being useful in a neighborhood.
Well, I mean, if you look at an area that size is within a residential area, they're again just a little under 3 acres. I mean, there's parklands that are that size throughout the city that are highly used. They have development. They may be playgrounds or picnic facilities that serve a community or a particular neighborhood. This is not the case. This is a very industrial part of the city. The value, of course, is the property along Paseo, which is the beautiful boulevard to the east of this property. So it's kind of a little bit of an isolated piece of land, as you mentioned earlier, and there again, the Tracy Street dead ends at that location. So they're again kind of off the main road and not really a good open space use.
So there were two parcels on the chopping block on that last ballot, and the other one is near Crown Center. That one is a little more vibrant, I guess you could say, just because of the vibrancy of the surroundings. And some news came out just yesterday about what's happening with that one.
Yes, exactly right. Actually, I think it was in the morning paper. This is adjacent to the Children's Mercy Campus, Children's Mercy Hospital. It's right there at Locust and Gillam, about 23rd Street. And it's a sliver of land, about a half acre in size. And there again, it's up on the high ground there to the east of the Gillam Road. And they're again going to the voters to get approval to dispose of that. And it's a very small piece of land. I mean, you've got the Gillam right-of-way, you have Hospital Hill Park. There are very vibrant areas. And so this piece of land is not going to, by taking it out of the system, it has no adverse or negative impact on the adjacent boulevard or the park.
So I'll admit that one is kind of an awkward size and shape, but it is in such a booming part of town, and the skeptic in me can't help but wonder if part of the question is, in addition to how necessary or useful the land is to the Parks Department right now, what is the question of what you can get for that land at this particular moment have to do with it?
Well, the way this is done is, first to be clear, is that when this goes to the voter, this is all by city charter. Once parkland becomes parkland, it's parkland forever. The only way that that can happen for it to be relinquished is to go to a vote of the entire population of Kansas City. And as you mentioned earlier, both items were at the ballot back in November, and they were approved by 80-some percent. This does not necessarily transfer the property to another owner. It just allows us then to go out for bid. We would go out for bid, and then the highest bidder in this case, you know, who would be able to provide us the most compensation, gets the land.
Right, but the bidders would be bidding an awful lot for that land right now.
That would probably be correct.
And I'm just curious if that has anything to do with the timing,
Well, the way that we determine the value of land, we would do an appraisal, which is being done, and so we know what the market value is, and then again, as the numbers go out and sent out to the folks that we want to bid on it, that's how we determine. Of course, when the bids come in, we'll know exactly who the new owner is.
So why now? Why is the Parks Department getting rid of parcels of land one ballot at a time right now?
Well, first off, we can only do this when there is a public vote. There happened to be two of them on this November ballot, and we've had them in the past. I mean, we had a couple of them back in 2016.
I guess by now, I mean, in recent years, I feel like this has been coming up on ballots a lot.
Well, there again, two of them in November of this year. There was two in 2016. If you go back several years, there hasn't been all that many. I did a little quick research on that, and going back to the mid-90s, there's been about a dozen since the mid-90s, so, you know, 24 years, about 12 over that period of time.
Okay, but why these particular parcels right now? I mean, what is it that, is it causing some problem for the Parks Department, or is there an opportunity that you see?
I think we're looking at all of our parkland throughout the city, both whether we decommission land or whether we acquire land. And we have about 12,000 acres throughout the entire metropolitan area. And, of course, that's in all four counties, for the most part, Jackson, Clay, and Platt. And as we look at the expansion of our system, we're most likely going to be adding some parkland north of the river as that area develops, or maybe to the southeast quadrant of the city. And as you look at the rest of the city, we may be adding land there too, or we may be removing sections of property. And these are relatively small tracts of land. If you talked earlier, a little under 3 acres or a half acre compared to 12,000 acres, that's not a lot of land. And I think you look at these, you know, one-on-one, these are not treated lightly. It does take a lot of review and discussion before this goes forward. Starts out with a resolution by the park board, and then that has to go to the city council for their concurrence before it ever goes to the voters.
What is the benefit of not having them in the system anymore?
Maintenance is part of it. I mean, if you have a piece of land that is no longer having to be part of the system, we no longer have to maintain it. And there is some value in this land, too, associated with that.
So value, financial value.
Yes.
Why do you think these particular parcels have been so underutilized? My visits yesterday made me think a lot about why one park area draws throngs of people, especially on a bizarrely warm December afternoon, and then another one sits totally empty.
I think it's a couple things. One is proximity or location. The other thing that relates to that is what's on that land, whether it's developed or not.
Yeah, that one on 21st and Tracy, there's just nothing.
Well, that's a good reason to look at what we've done with that because of nothing on it. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a building there that served a park purpose when it was a maintenance facility, but the building, you know, was built back in the 20s. I mean, the building needs to be removed at this point. So basically, it's a way of getting rid of some blight. The new owner of that property will have to remove that building. If that new owner then does that, we would not have to incur the cost of removing the building.
So then, but I guess I was just thinking about that there's the option of getting rid of it because it's underutilized, but then there's also the option of putting something on it that would draw more people and make it more of a community resource?
Well, we look at that with all of our parks. I use the example of the other location you mentioned where you have Hospital Hill Park, which is adjacent to that. There's a playground there. There's a basketball court. There's a shelter. There's a lot of good public benefit in that piece of land. And again, park land is designed to serve the adjacent community. So if there's constituents and useful benefit for the surrounding community, well then, yes, the parkland would be developed. And there's multiple examples of neighborhood parks, multiple examples of public facilities throughout the park and boulevard system that we can point to and see where they're highly benefited to the community.
The one near Crown Center is just kind of catty-corner from Washington Park. That's the one across Main from Union Station or across Pershing from Crown Center?
No, this is further east. If you can visualize the used to be the Hyatt, now it's the Sheraton Hotel.
Yeah.
Right on Gillam, which now that's on the west side of Gillam Road. Hospital Hill Campus, which is Children's Mercy, is on the east side. It's on the east side of Gillam at Locust, which is
kind of that sloping.
Yes, there's a slope there. That's correct.
So are there detractors? I mean, you talked about an 80% approval rate from voters on just on going ahead and saying goodbye to these parcels as part of the Parks Department. Are there people who vocally oppose this?
We have not heard from anyone on these two particular ones. I mean, you know, I think 82% was approved, so there's, 18% of the voters that did not support it. But no one has actually communicated their concerns to us.
Something I have wondered is how hard it would be to create a park where there currently isn't one. Does that still happen? You talked about acquiring land. Does the Parks Department routinely acquire land and turn it into some kind of recreation or green space? Or are those days kind of over?
Well, let me give you an example of that. We have a subdivision regulation in Kansas City. So if a developer were to develop a residential property, let's just say it's 100 homes within some area of the city, they would be required by ordinance to dedicate park land as part of that subdivision or homeowners. So if you build the 100 homes, those families are going to want someplace to go, and that would be a neighborhood park would be an example of that. So it may be a 3 or 4 acre tract of land that's within the neighborhood. And so they would then donate that land or dedicate it over to us as part of that subdivision regulation. So we acquire land that way. That's probably the best example of how land is added to the system.
In a place, I guess my at least theoretical reservation about this is that if we let go of parkland one seemingly insignificant piece at a time, maybe we don't see a use or need for that particular park location right now. But once green space gets filled in and developed, I imagine it would be awfully hard for it to get back. And that's, we're talking about very dense and increasingly dense parts of the city.
I think it's a very good point. And that's why we look at these very carefully. We don't treat this lightly. As I mentioned earlier, these doesn't happen all that often. It may have been two in November, but there may not be another one for a period of time. So yes, we look at it very closely. And you're right, once it is no longer green space, coming back, it would be very hard to do. That's why it goes back to when our charter was written back in 1892. We're a 125-year-old park system. And over the 125 years, it really hasn't happened. Very, very seldom has it happened in 125 years. I gave the example of the last 24 years. And so yes, we look at it very closely. And that's why you have to go to the vote of the people. I mean, if this could be done administratively, it would be a lot different than having to go to the complete vote.
Are these requests coming from an internal process at the Parks Department? I have heard rumors that developers are the ones bringing these proposals to you.
They can come both ways. They can come, that can be an initiative from the park board, or it can come from an adjacent property owner that has an interest. And we would look at it both ways. An example from, I believe it was back in 99, was an initiative launched by the city where we actually went to the voters to remove a 6-acre tract of land off of Berry Road in the Northland. And what happened at that one, we actually traded that 6 acres for 125 acres, a 50-acre tract of land and a 75-acre tract of land. So the net benefit to the community was lose 6, gain 125. And I think you can see the value in that. And today, that 125 acres is providing good community services and benefits for recreational purposes in that part of the city.
I know that even the Parks Department, like everyone needs money to do what they do and to do it well. And I get that. I guess I also have, though, this idealistic notion that the parks are this shared resource of the people. And no matter how wealthy or how poor, you have this like this lawn that is yours in the Parks Department. And the idea that developers might be hungry for land in a certain part of town as something that would factor into the decision about whether to hold on to or let go of parkland, I guess I am a little bit, like, kind of uncomfortable hearing about that.
Well, what you started out your comment about green space being valuable, that's the world we live in. I mean, we're all about green. We're all about open space. We're all about areas where everybody can be there. I mean, when you talk about a park, it's not going to determine, you know, who that person is, whether where they come from, the color of their skin, or who they might happen to be. It's for parks are for everybody, and we believe parks are for everybody, and that's what they should be used for. And that's what we continue to strive to do and build a good quality park system throughout our city. But there is some cases where you might look at, and I'm going to call these slivers of land, that that can be utilized in a different way. So we don't take it lightly because we believe exactly what you're saying, Jean, in relationship to the overall park system.
So are you done getting rid of parcels? Or are there more to come?
Well,
am I going to be visiting parcels on an afternoon in the near future?
I would say that we will look at everything on a case-by-case basis. I mean, I think we're done for 2017. There's no more public votes in 2017. But as we look forward, we'll look at a much we'll give a close eye to anything that might come up.
Mark McHenry, Director of Parks and Recreation for Kansas City, Missouri, thanks for explaining this whole thing. I appreciate it. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, the murals by Thomas Hart Benton that Union Station wouldn't hang in 1941. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's next. Thomas Hart Benton painted lively scenes of ordinary daily life here in the Midwest. Except that one year when he didn't. Benton spent 1941 trying to warn people about the looming threat of international fascism in a gruesome series written off by some at the time as propaganda. That series is called The Year of Peril, and it's what we'll be talking about for the rest of today's show. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Steve Sitton from the Thomas Hart Benton Home and Studio. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
So you're giving some talks on this series coming up at the Mid-Continent Public Library, and you just spoke last night at the National Archives downtown. What's got you thinking about the Year of Peril series right now?
Well, it's a series I do these programs periodically, a lot of them for the Mid-Continent system, but Thursday is the anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, so this one is very timely, because that was the trigger for Benton of why he did these paintings.
Tell me the story.
So Benton was talking about that, you know, because of the international situation, war in Europe and in Asia, he had trouble painting, and so he decided he would do a lecture series and talk about his painting ideas. And he said he was on the stand in Cincinnati when he heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And he said he had an idea. He was going to come back to Kansas City to a studio here. And he was going to try and wake the Middle West up to the danger that faced us.
Specifically the Middle West?
Yes.
So he didn't imagine that this was an audience like any other. There was something particular about the people in this region and their attitude or something?
Well, there was certainly an attitude that the war was in the distance. It was overseas and potentially on the American coast, Seattle, San Francisco, New York, Charleston, things like that. But Tom was warning the folks here that if we weren't careful and if everybody didn't contribute, then we might see war and casualties, you know, here in the farms and cities of the Midwest as well.
So that was his kind of nightmare vision?
It really was. And his intention was to hang these paintings in Union Station.
Did he already have a commission for Union Station or was...
No,
he just cooked that up in his head.
Yep, that was his idea.
Why Union Station?
Because it was one of the biggest stations in the country, and there were a lot of travelers going through there. So, and especially it ended out a lot of soldiers and sailors were transiting through Union Station.
How long did it take him to create? So there are eight of these
paintings?
Correct.
And he did them all in 9 weeks. And some of them are very, very large. The largest one is 8 foot by 6 foot.
8 paintings in 9 weeks is insane.
He was a man on a mission.
What do you know about those weeks?
Not a lot. He didn't ever keep a diary or anything.
He probably didn't do much other than paint.
Right. So he seems to really have just knocked them out. He must have put in some very long hours. In some cases, the paintings are not artistically the best or most complete. I know one of the panels, you can have actually even see some of the underdrawing where he didn't even get the paint completely on the canvas.
There, one of these paintings is called Indifference, and it looks to me like a nod to that painting, The Scream, the really famous painting by Edvard Munch, where the guy's like holding his face and standing on a bridge. The color scheme and the swirling brush strokes are very similar, but instead of a swirly-headed guy screaming on a bridge, there are swirly-headed people who have been dismembered on the ground by a fallen plane.
I think I hadn't put that connection together. I see what you're talking about, though, with that. And these colors that he uses in this series are a little different than his typical colors. I think
there's a lot of red, but that's because there's a lot of
there's
blood.
There's a lot of blood. They are very gory. And yes, there's a dismembered head there and some planes. I think actually what he's really portraying there is almost the attack on Pearl Harbor and that our planes have been destroyed. And he actually wrote a little comment what he means in each of these paintings. And for Indifference, he says that because of the indifference, the inertia of America, and we were unprepared for this, that young men died and machines were needlessly destroyed before we even knew that war was upon us.
What are some of the other painting titles?
So one is called The Sowers. So it's this almost giant looking man, and he's throwing skulls out into a field. There is The Harvest, where he's talking about the farmers of America. You have to work very hard this year. And so it's a family that is, again, being bayoneted, and it's some really awful stuff in a lot of ways.
Yeah, these paintings are all so gruesome. Lots of impaling and severed limbs and nudity and chaos.
Yes.
The nudity is a little surprising. Like, most of these victims of horrible things happening to them are naked.
Raping and pillaging, yes. And I think what Tom really is, what we're seeing here is his hysteria. We've just been attacked. This was a surprise attack. In early 1942, America was losing the war. We weren't as heavily involved in Europe yet, but in the Pacific, we were losing the war. And so there was a lot of fear. And I think Tom is painting that, and I think he captures the attitude of America at that point.
He meant for these to hang in Union Station, as you mentioned. It is sort of hard to imagine a traveling hub with, you know, people going to and fro and just a little severed limbs as you're... I mean, that is hard to imagine. Did he think that Union Station was going to, like, be excited about this?
I don't know that he'd given that much thought, but his plan was to shock people.
It seems like that would have happened had they gone up in Union Station. What happened with all of that? How did he set about pursuing that particular part of his dream?
His agent, Reeves Lowenthal, who had a gallery in New York City, contacted Tom and said, "Tom, this is no local affair. Let me take care of this. I'll make it a national affair." And his agent was able to sell these paintings to Abbott Laboratories out of Chicago. It was a big pharmaceutical industry that supplied medicines for the armed forces. They bought these paintings for $20,000.
Help me understand the economics of the time, because $20,000 is a lot of money, but in 1941, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, yes, for these 8 paintings. And then Reeves, I don't know the economics of it, you know, what that would translate to today's dollars. But then Reeves had an exhibit of these paintings in his gallery in New York. 75,000 people came through to see these paintings.
But in New York, Thomas Hart Benton wanted to wake up the Middle West.
But then every newspaper in the country carried them. They did some 300,000 posters of these. So people saw these all over the country.
So, you know, I guess the difference, I have heard that part of it, too, though, is that the difference between art and propaganda. Mm-hmm. Like, did Union Station at some point hear about Benton's plan?
Not that I know of. I don't think it even went that far. I think his agent jumped right in and said, "Nope, I can get these spread a lot farther.
Is there a gray area in your mind between art and propaganda? Because I've heard that a lot of people did dismiss this as not art.
Well, there is an artistic element to propaganda, certainly. And, you know, there are some propaganda posters, you know, from World War I, World War II that have some very beautiful art in them. But in general, I think the art in propaganda is designed to either raise your own people up, to inspire them. So you have these very heroic, noble-looking young soldiers going off to war, smiling families, you know, we're going to go raise money for war bonds, or the propaganda is designed to demoralize the enemy. And I don't think these paintings quite succeeded in either way.
Inspirational is definitely not a word that I would attach to any of these.
No.
Can you pick one that really fascinates you and really set the scene for our listeners and help us understand the message of one of these paintings?
Let's see. One of the ones that's probably the most surprising that doesn't quite fit in with all the rest of them is called Again. And it's a large painting, 47 by 56 inches, and it shows the Christ figure up on the cross. There is a German plane that is strafing him, and then down on the ground you have these very xenophobic, caricature, stereotypical Italian and German soldiers and a Japanese ogre, this brute, holding a long lance, and they're spearing Christ in the side. So he's taken this religious scene that everybody kind of recognizes, and he's put it into this wartime situation.
How do you sort out some of what's going on there? Because if you think about the politics of the time, you know, he's trying to make this stance against fascism, but mixed in with that is all this racial stereotyping.
Yes, it is. Part of it, I think, is, again, as we often do during war times, dehumanize the enemy. That makes it easier to attack them and kill them. And Tom said, you know, we have to fight just as hard and just as nasty as they do. And if we don't, democracy, as we know, is lost.
Does any of this story complicate for you what people generally think of Thomas Hart Benton as being, or what we think of our local history at this time as being?
I think what it does is it shows him as a complex person who has these reactions, these very visceral gut reactions to a horrific event.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we will get back to this conversation about Thomas Hart Benton's Year of Peril with Steve Sitton in just a minute. If you have a question about this controversial series that never did get displayed in Union Station to wake up Middle America, call 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm here with Steve Sitton of the Thomas Hart Benton Home and Studio Historic Site. He'll be giving a talk on Benton's Year of Peril at the Mid-Continent Public Library's Raytown branch this Thursday at 7. Hi again, Steve.
Hello.
So just to recap for people who are catching up with us, this series was an about-face for Benton. He hadn't been painting for a while, and then he was so disturbed and freaked out by the bombing at Pearl Harbor that he turned his focus really dramatically and passionately into a platform to warn people about fascism. He painted 8 giant paintings in 9 weeks.
Yes.
What do we know about Benton's politics before this moment?
Benton does come from a political family. His father, Colonel M.E. Benton, was a 4-term U.S. congressman. His great-great-uncle, who he's named for, Senator Benton, was Missouri's first U.S. senator, the longest senator. So Benton comes from this populist political tradition. He talks about that when he was a boy, William Jennings Bryan and Champ Clark had breakfast at the Benton home. So he grows up in this political family. He is supposed to become a politician, a lawyer. And throughout a lot of his artwork, there is this social populist political message. His core belief was common art for the common man. So even though he is often painting these rural sorts of scenes, but it is rural labor that he often paints.
You know, there was a word you used earlier. I mean, you said that these paintings capture Benton's hysteria at this moment after the bombing at Pearl Harbor. And there's a connotation there that someone's maybe like overly worked up about something. But international fascism was a giant, I mean, horrific things were happening.
Sure. And the public was a little bit aware of this. There had been some media coverage, of course. And World War II, even before America gets directly involved, was one of the first wars where civilian populations on a large scale were affected. Guernica, the Rape of Nanking, the bombings, the air raids in London, things like that. And so Tom also is kind of in these Year of Peril paintings showing our American civilian populations here in the Middle West might be affected as well if we don't fight back and fight hard.
A former guest on this show, a muralist by the name of Dave Lowenstein, sent me an email this morning, and I want to read it. He says, "I'm looking forward to your show about Benton's Year of Peril series. The difficult content in them reminded me of the ongoing controversy about his murals at the University of Indiana. In one section, Benton depicts reporters in 1928 revealing government ties to the Klan. Students have signed a petition to have the murals removed because the Klan is depicted, even though Benton was clearly condemning them. Others believe they should be put in context and taught." I mean, can Benton's intent be hard to read in his more political works?
It can be. I think that's why in these Year of Peril paintings, he did write a pamphlet and explain what he meant about each one of these paintings and what the message he was trying to convey.
Let's talk with one of our callers. We've got Ara with us from Jefferson County, Kansas. Hi, Ara.
Hi, yeah. I was very intrigued by your conversation this morning. I was the caretaker of John Stuart Curry's home here in Jefferson County, Kansas, who is actually Thomas Hart Benton's best friend. They are the regionalists, as we call them here in the Midwest, from Kansas, Missouri, and Iowa, which would include Grant Wood. They all lived in New York City together, and they were bounced out politically off each other quite often. In fact, they discussed the concerns of putting out politicizing their art with John Stuart Curry doing that famous scene with John Brown and you were talking about the violence that they painted with those Union Confederate dead with John Brown swirling, soldiers behind him.
Swirling also a shared technique.
It looked like a tornado. He was given enormous amount of backlash because many people in the state didn't want to have this as a part of their history. And he would also go on to become...
And depicted it in the Capitol.
Right, it is depicted in the Capitol. And it has become very controversial because as you come up and down this 1920 on the Otis elevator, what you see is these fiery eyes of John Brown staring you at the face. And he spoke at length about this with his good friends, both Grant Wood and Thomas Hart Benton, about the country. Newspaper articles were written about it, about whether or not this was appropriate for an artist to become politicized. Thomas Hart Benton would have the same challenge. But Thomas Hart Benton's in a unique situation. His grandfather was a sitting U.S. senator during the Civil War.
Wow. So,
Hart Benton Sr.
Talk to me more about... You're sharing that newspapers at the time for general readership are debating this issue of whether it's appropriate for an artist to have a political message. Can you talk to me more about that and about these conversations among the artists themselves?
I'm an American historian, so I've worked at the Kansas State Capitol, my local historical study here, and at the U.S. Capitol. And one of the biggest challenges was that many persons living in the community did not want to reflect upon a controversial past. They wanted to be a bit more optimistic and not show that there was a division of patriotism. They didn't want to show that there was ever a divide in the country. And though even during coming up into the Second World War years, people were struggling with issues such as depression and then going on into the Second World War. Now, John Stuart Curry would die before the Second World War would end. And I often think that Thomas Hart Benton felt that this was something he should take up. You know, that this was that some of the artists that were working with him either couldn't because they were deceased or for whatever reasons weren't able to do this kind of work. And so I really think that both patriotically, because of the history of his family, his grandfather has a statue inside the United States Capitol commemorating him from Missouri.
Yeah. Okay, Ara, thank you so much. And I want to get our in-studio guests' response to some of this.
That was something that Benton struggled with. During the 1920s, he was living in New York City in Greenwich Village. He flirted with Marxism back then, like a lot of the artists did. And he later broke with them because they really wanted him to use the artwork to preach the political message. And Benton often does paint workers, but they aren't generally being quite as exploited as the Marxists wanted him to depict. And again, there is this political background to Benton. As you mentioned, his ancestor that he's named for was a four-term U.S. senator. So there is in Tom's artwork, again, this social realism sort of message. And you mentioned the Depression. In 1941, Benton did a painting called After Many Springs. And in the background, there is a farmer plowing, a very typical sort of regionalist Benton theme. But in the foreground, there is a skull and a rusted revolver. And I think Tom's showing that, you know, during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, some of the farmers did take that way out. So I think, again, he does have messages there, and his messages, he doesn't always paint the pretty side of life, and Year of Peril takes that to the extreme.
Let's talk to Nathan in Overland Park. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. I remember that in like the 1930s, especially late 1930s, there were people like Henry Ford who thought that Mussolini and Hitler were reasonable alternatives to what Roosevelt was doing. And there were people who, like, for example, tried to overthrow Roosevelt because the New Deal was too socialistic, the Wall Street Putsch. So what was Benton's reply to businessmen like Henry Ford? And it's especially prescient when you consider that Donald Trump made news a couple of years ago for saying that Roosevelt was right to intern the Japanese during World War II because it was wartime.
Okay, a few different questions in there. I guess we'll start with we'll get to that second question about internment in a moment, but the first question was about people believing that Hitler and Mussolini were reasonable alternatives to the kind of leadership they were seeing here in the United States.
Benton really did become a New Deal Democrat. He actually ended up thinking that the New Deal was not going far enough. But he felt that originally the New Deal would reform American society and the American economy. But again, he did become disillusioned with that. After that, Benton does become a pretty good friend of Harry Truman.
Thinking about the context of that moment, I mean, hindsight, you know, I think there is a lot more consensus about this time period now probably than there was at the time. Mm-hmm. In the context of the time, can you give us a sense of how radical these paintings were?
The Year of Peril paintings?
Yes.
Yes. Well, again, they made a very big splash. Almost everybody saw them. Every newspaper covered them, had reproductions of them. But then because they were too shocking, they were too scary, maybe they then pretty quickly disappeared. And then
There are giant paintings depicting dismemberment. It is hard to imagine the location where, regardless of a person's political views, where those are
appropriate
or just where people are going to be psyched to have that.
Sure, sure. So in 1944, Abbott Laboratories that had purchased these paintings transferred them, donated them to the State Historical Society in Columbia, and that's where they are now. And they do sometimes have them on exhibit. These paintings, because I think they are an important part of Benton's career and a little bit forgotten about, there is some new scholarship about them.
They're so intense. It is a little crazy to me that they've been forgotten to mm-hmm. the extent that they have. I mean, I've lived in Kansas City most of my life, and I'm interested in art, and I've never heard of this before.
Right, right. So that's why I'm out trying to do this program. And again, Benton's not just...
How can you forget these paintings? They're crazy.
They're scary. They are scary. Can I go back and finish the rest of Nathan's question? I don't have an answer for him about the internment camps. Benton never said anything about those. So I don't really want to talk about that a whole lot.
But I guess what I wanted to bring up from that question mm-hmm. is that we mentioned before this sort of tension between wanting to demonize the enemy because mm-hmm. you're trying to warn people this stuff is really bad, but then that racial caricature comes out of that. That, I mean, the internment camps are a good example of that's dangerous.
Sure. Benton's daughter, Jessie, talks about his incredible sense of justice and fairness. Tom was a member of the NAACP, the American Civil Liberties Union, and he was married to an Italian immigrant. And so this painting, again, of Christ on the cross and the Japanese and Italian and German soldiers stabbing him in the side, how did his relationship with his wife, his Italian wife, get affected by that?
Do you know the answer to that?
A little bit. Set myself up there.
Good question.
Rita in mid-April 1942 said that Tom's impatient to get back home to paint my flowers. That will be a change after all of this.
So maybe a sense of relief?
Relief or, you know, we'll let this craziness, this nightmare phase pass.
When you think about Thomas Hart Benton's life and career, do you think that these paintings show a side of him that people need to understand, or do you think that they show more just a slice of life at this really tense moment?
I think it's the latter. It's a glimpse into American psyche, in early 1942.
What do you know about what people thought when they saw these paintings in New York?
Well, they did have the desired effect of shocking people. And a lot of the newspapers initially in April 1942, when these were first exhibited in New York, did praise them and say things like, you know, they're monstrous to size and to color, but everybody's talking about these paintings.
When you talk about these paintings, because you have had a lot of mm-hmm. speaking engagements about them, do people ever bring up just the politics or events of our own time, our own, like, life memories?
Sure. And I don't want to say I enjoy doing this program, but it is one of the most interesting presentations I do. You have to have a reaction to these paintings. They are so bold and shocking. And a lot of people don't like them. Some people like them, understand them. But I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
I mean, do people sometimes make the comparison between Pearl Harbor and September 11th? Does that ever come up?
Yes, it definitely does. This feeling immediately after September 11th, what happened? Who did this? What are we going to do next? Is this going to happen again?
A feeling of being possibly just under siege.
Under siege and surprised and unprepared and fearful.
Has anyone had like a strong reaction to these paintings based on their experience with September 11th?
Not that I know of. Not to me, they haven't. Immediately after September 11th, I do have two prints of these paintings at the Benton home, and I went ahead and put them on display in the studio without any comment. Just, this is what Benton painted, you know, after Pearl Harbor. We're now in mid-September of 2001, and let people kind of draw their own conclusions.
Let's talk to Don in Kansas City. Hi, Don.
Hi. So, I saw a few of these paintings at the Nelson Atkins when the Benton show was on, and
yes.
They gave me some perspective about my own father, who was an artist during the 20th century, an artist and illustrator. And he actually illustrated war bond posters during World War II. And there was a Christmas card, a family Christmas card that he did near the beginning of the war. So I guess it must have been right after Pearl Harbor. It always shocked me. It always shocked me, and it was something I wasn't very proud of him for. But then I saw those paintings of Benton's at the Nelson, and I got a better idea of the attitude of the time. So my father's card, and his name was Alex F. Jaworski, his card showed a Christmas tree with cartoon characters of Mussolini, Hitler, and Hirohito hanging from the tree with nooses. And it was you know, extremely xenophobic and an awful thing for a Christmas card. But I got a little more understanding of the attitude of the times after I saw Benton's paintings.
What was it that you understood better exactly? Can you put your finger on it? Just how scared people were?
Well, like you were talking about earlier, the fact that those shock value in dehumanizing the enemy. And I think that's what my father was doing.
And so seeing Benton doing kind of the same thing made you maybe more at peace with that?
A little bit, yeah.
It sounds like you still have some reservations.
Well, it's a pretty horrifying Christmas card. So I was born in 48, so that was before my time. I understand it a little bit more.
Well, thanks for that call, Don.
You're welcome.
For you, Steve, I mean, you have people coming to the Benton home for all sorts of different reasons. I mean, it probably ranges from a deep interest in Thomas Hart Benton to an easy day trip,
just
fun travel back in time kind of afternoon or something.
Let's go see an old house.
Yeah. Yes. And so when you take a moment to bring out some of his more political works because the moment feels right to you, have you ever gotten strong reactions to that? People who are surprised or maybe even upset?
Not so much upset, but certainly interested in them and intrigued by them.
Talk to me more about there are eight of these paintings, and we've talked about a couple. Tell us about one more that we haven't heard about.
As the war went on, Tom actually did do some more sorts of artwork that was more traditional propaganda. And so I think maybe he learned his lesson that these didn't have a great reaction. So then he did one called Back Them Up, and it shows this soldier charging forward, and there is a farmer and a factory worker, you know, pushing him onward, and there's a factory in the background that's, you know, producing this war material. The Navy also hired him to do a series of paintings about one of their new naval submarines and about the building of a landing craft.
So more about the political message than about the internal turmoil that really does make its way in these paintings onto the canvas.
Right. And as the tide of the war started to turn maybe a little bit too, that certainly would have had an effect on that.
It's interesting that more toward propaganda is the direction that he took things when he realized that people didn't like what he was doing.
Well, and I think this is that propaganda effort that he moves to is more of the good kind of patriotism.
What do you mean by that?
It's less of an overreaction and the scariness.
But it's so hard to say overreaction when you're talking about World War II.
True.
Well, our time is up. Steve Sitton, thank you so much for joining us from the Thomas Hart Benton home and studio in Valentine.
You're quite welcome.
Steve's got two upcoming talks scheduled on this series. One is this week, Thursday at 7 at the Raytown branch of the Mid-Continent Public Library. You can go online for more details, and that is a wrap. You can listen back to today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard, and go ahead and look up some of our previous conversations about Thomas Hart Benton. He is an interesting guy, for sure. Tomorrow, people domesticated their dogs, right? That's what we think, being the people in that relationship. New research from KU and Haskell turns that a little bit on its head. Don't miss that conversation. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. Linda Scher is on the board for us, and Up to Date is next. Stick around.